Leash on alcohol. Oh, God. Is this on?
It's on. And don't worry, you can just talk anywhere you want to. I'll pick you right up.
Do I need it?
Yes.
Probably.
Okay. 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 You know, when you have to drive 2.5 hours to get here, I did keep myself really occupied. Did I say Felicia, I'm an alcohol?
Yes, you did.
Okay,
you
thank
did.
You. I kept myself really occupied with my my riding companion, who was gracious enough to give me a ride up here, because right now I have a car that does not have air conditioning, and it's very hot lately. So anyway, I kept myself really occupied, and normally I take a little bit more time to center and focus a little bit and ask my higher power for the words that I need to help myself and to help me express my journey in a way that will help someone else understand as well. And I pray that that I will be able to say something that will really help someone that needs help today. And since I didn't do that on the car, I just did it now with you guys, with everyone hearing me. So I my sobriety date is May 7th, 1992. I got sober in Annapolis, Maryland. I was 10 years old. Just kidding. I feel so old when I say that. I feel really, really old when I say that. I was 26 years old, and I live in Williamsburg now. I've been living there for about 16 years, and I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, which is Sunday morning First Colony meeting, this Sunday morning Serenity group. And I have always had a home group. I have almost always had a sponsor. I have read the big book. I have worked the steps. I have worked with sponsees. I have done all of the things that you all have asked me to do that enables me to stay sober. And sometimes I'm still a little uncomfortable with talking about the length of sobriety that I have, because I feel like there's an expectation that I just have magic words flowing out of my mouth all of the time, and that I'm super wise, and that maybe I have like this glow. And that is not the case. And I realized recently, I was at a meeting, and I realized a lot of times I don't, you know, when I was early in sobriety, I used to plan. You know, I'd hear somebody say something, and then I'd hear someone else say something, and I'd start thinking about, or they'd say the topic, and I'd think, what am I going to say? It has to be really profound and perfect. And I wouldn't be able to hear anything else that was being said in the meeting, because I was thinking about what I was going to say that was so profound and perfect. And I don't do that anymore. I don't think about what I'm going to say. I say my prayers, and then I open my mouth, and I trust that my higher power is going to do all the heavy lifting. So anyway, I have done anything else in my life. I don't like commitment. I don't like showing up. I don't like agreeing to anything. Not only do I not want to commit to you, I don't want to commit to an idea. I don't want to commit to a promise. You know, I don't want to do anything that I think might extract anything from me that I might not be willing to do. And y'all, I have done this 32 years. It's 32, 31, whatever. I don't even know. It's shocking to me. This has outlasted most of my friendships. Of course, it's outlasted jobs. I've been sober longer than I've been a parent. And it even outlasted my marriage. And I've learned that because I've been using this design for living sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, sometimes willingly, sometimes not willingly, over time, just by coming in here one more time and putting my butt in the chair one more time, not committing to next week, next month, next year, just showing up one more time and listening to what you all have to say to me. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is who I am today. It is truly who I am. It is truly, I hope what I project to other people. It has truly changed the way I walk through life, the way I interpret life, the way I treat people. It has truly changed me. And before I'm a mom, a friend, a partner, an employer, an employee, before I'm any of those things, I'm an alcoholic who's recovering in AA. Now, just because it is a part of me, and I have all these tools at my disposal, doesn't mean that I'm still not completely crazy, and doesn't mean that I still don't have crazy thoughts, and that I still don't struggle with doing the wrong thing, and that I still don't make bad choices, and that I still don't do all of the things that alcoholics do. I do that. I still have struggles. I still have fears. It's what I do with those today that is the big difference. You know, it's how I respond to those. It's how I pause when those things happen. And I try not to react as much. It's amazing to me how this way of life can so radically affect the people around us. My children have never seen me drunk. What a freaking gift. Because I know for sure I would have left them alone to go out. I would have left them alone to go to the store to buy alcohol. I would have shut the door and let them cry because I had something better I had to do. I would have neglected them. I would have put my needs before theirs. I know that. I absolutely know that. And luckily, God didn't grace me with kids before I got sober. So anyway, I had, I guess to some, a pretty short drinking and drugging career. I started drinking alcohol when I was 13. And prior to that, I was really... like I needed more caffeine. I'm shaking like a leaf. I was super smart and super dorky and kind of fat and goofy looking. And I had no siblings and I grew up just with my mother. My father died when I was a year and a half. And, you know, back in the late 60s, early 70s, single moms was kind of an anomaly. You didn't see a lot of that, and definitely didn't see a lot of only kids. And my family, my mother was an only child. My father had one sibling who we were estranged from. I had no family. I had no cousins, not a single cousin. I had one uncle that, like I said, we were estranged from him. And so I already felt really different. I already felt, I had no frame of reference for much of anything except my mom. And God love her, she did the very best she could, but she was all about how you look and what you say and who you can get things from. And because that's how she was raised, you know, that's how she was raised. She did the best she could with what she had. But my earliest memories were of, I had to be perfect because I was the only thing she had. She reminded me of that a lot. And I somehow understood that my father had died and was gone. And I thought, if I am not perfect, she's going to disappear and I'm going to be here all by myself. So I spent a lot of time looking at her to dictate how I should act. I don't know if that makes sense. And so I learned that I should be looking to other people to determine who I should be, what I should say, and how I should act. And when I verbalize that, I think, oh God, gross. You know, how lame, how weak. But it's the truth. It is the truth. And early on, when I was 13, there was this little girl I was friends with in middle school, and you know, she just lived with her mom and had no siblings. And she invited me home from school one day, and we rode the bus home, and we walked into our house, and she opened the pantry door, and there was all this great stuff. And drinking was never, we did spend time with grandparents. My mom and I visited grandparents, grandmothers, grandfathers all died. I grew up with no men, which definitely played a part in all kinds of trouble I had later on. But alcohol was never a big secret. It was never taboo. Alcohol was always presented to me as a reward, a gift, glamorous, cool, sexy, definitely a reward. Definitely what you deserve after good news, bad news, a hard day, a fun day. It's what you use to celebrate. It's what you use to grieve. Alcohol was always the answer for everything. And I had in my mind very early on, boy, I can't wait till I'm old enough to do that. And so I went home with this girl, Julie, and there it was. And she's like, do you want a drink? And I was like, sure. And it was a Friday, and I was spending the night at her house. And by the end of the night, we'd gone out in the neighborhood, and I flirted with all the neighborhood boys who were all bad news boys. And you know, all of a sudden I wasn't the fat girl. I was funny, and we were running around being crazy, and I had no social life prior to that. And I decided right then and there, I love how this feels. I love how it helps me talk. This is what I want to be. I don't want to be the smart girl anymore. I want to be the girl that everyone knows drinks and can drink. And at 13, I look at how my daughter was at 13. And it's so sad to me that that is all I aspired to. That is truly all I aspired to. Now I knew that, you know, I probably want to go to college. You know, I think I thought maybe I want to get married. I definitely, definitely always wanted children. Always. Because I was so lonely when I was growing up, and I really did not want to have any kids that felt that loneliness. So from age 13 until 26, I drank as much as I could, whenever I could. And I did manage, you know, I graduated from high school. I had a 3.9 grade point average. I was still at that point where I was really, putting out perfection. You know, I was smart. I was pretty fun. I'm actually here with someone that knew me in high school who might be able to say, yeah, you were pretty cool. You know, I don't know that anybody thought that I was miserable and in pain. I don't think anybody knew that. I don't know that I really knew that. You know, anytime anything was uncomfortable, I looked for something to numb that always. Food, boys, alcohol, cigarettes. I went to the University of Georgia, and back then, it's not, you could be, you know, if you signed your name legibly on the application, you were pretty much getting in there, not like it is now. And I went there. I had gotten offered a full scholarship to a girls' school in North Carolina, and I thought that I would rather eat glass than go to a girls' school in North Carolina. And I turned down that scholarship, and that was my first real act of defiance. And I was pretty tickled with myself because my mom really wanted me to go, and I didn't have the nerve to tell her, blank you, I'm not going there. And I had a very controlling, domineering, difficult teacher who had worked really hard for me to get this scholarship, and said, I'm gonna go to Georgia because all my friends were going there because that was safe. You know, that was the safe place to go. And I went, and drugs became a big part of my story. And I managed to graduate in 5 years And I started having a lot of problems with depression and a lot of I started having a lot of questions internally, never with anybody else, but I started noticing that there were some people that seemed pretty okay with life. They weren't, I mean, I know today I met some people who were comfortable in their own skin, and it was such a strange thing to me. My mother was not comfortable in her skin. Most of my friends were not, you know, at that age, none of us really were. We didn't know how to be. And I was really curious about that. And I thought, well, you know, there's something wrong with me. Maybe I need to go to church. So I tried a couple of churches. I got books on Christianity and Buddhism and, you know, all kinds of stuff. I also did a lot. Is it okay if I talk about drugs here? Anyway, I did a lot of drugs too, thinking that would be something magical for me. And nothing was. And I got into some pretty destructive relationships. And I noticed that people around me towards the end of college were doing things like getting jobs and having internships and planning for their future. And I was working in a bar, and I had no plan. And I graduated, and I for a year and a half before I graduated, I saved a lot of money working in this bar, stealing from this bar. I saved up a lot of money, and I finally landed on a major, which was art history. My original desire was to be a photographer, and the first time I had to display my work, put up my work for a judge. No thanks. That was way too scary for me. I didn't want to do that. So I, on a whim, reactionary out of the fear and uncomfortability of being judged, could not handle any feedback at all, positive or negative. I changed my major from photography to art history. And the reason I did that was because I knew that I didn't want to leave art, but I didn't want to have the challenge of producing it because that was too scary. You know, that was, I would have to reveal something. And anyway, so I graduated. I took a long time, but I did. I graduated, and I had no plan. So I saved up all this money, and my roommate and I went to Europe for a few months to travel and backpack, and that was the only thing I could see getting that trip, doing having that experience. And it was a fantastic experience. It you know, it changed my life and my perspective in a lot of really great ways. But I was drunk the whole time, and I judged every place we went, all these beautiful, amazing places, by what do the locals drink, what do the cigarettes taste like, and what is their bread like? Cigarettes, alcohol, and bread. That's what I was curious about all these countries, because I'm obsessed with bread too. But and the big joke is now I know I have celiac and I can never eat bread. But anyway, so I came back, and I moved in with my mom, which was miserable. And at that point, she had relocated up to right outside Washington, D.C. And I moved in with her, and that was really terrible. And I was drinking at home every day because I had no plan and I was not prepared for life. And I moved out and got a bunch of not that great jobs. And dated not that great people because I didn't know what to, I didn't know how to do anything else. I didn't know how to not make bad choices with dating. I didn't know how to have a plan and work towards it. I didn't know how to do any of that. And anyway, to make a long story short, my roommate that I went to Europe with, she continued traveling. And she just got back from Indonesia. And she said, and by then it was a mess. I had created lots of problems. I had work problems. I couldn't, a week couldn't go by really every day. I was either late or leaving early. I couldn't produce what I needed to produce. I was working in a children's museum, and that was just, I couldn't do that. So I got a job for one of the women who worked on the board, really as just her, you know, her paid errand runner, you know. And so when my friend came back from Indonesia, she said, well, listen, my aunt and uncle have a boatyard up in Annapolis. Let's go up there. I was like, great. Because things had gotten really bad with the relationship. And I was like, I just need to get out of here. It was the first time I really made a conscious thought of a geographical cure. And I went to Annapolis in February of 1992. And we lived in this little tiny house. And we went to work at this boatyard scrubbing, because I was like, I just need great outdoors. I need physical work. I just need to clear my head. This is, you know, this will be good for me. So we started scrubbing boats on the Annapolis Harbor in February. And if anybody's been up there, it's miserable. It's cold. Boats are out of the water, dry dock, on jacks. It's really cold. It's not glamorous at all. And she met this guy who lived on a boat, that he was working on this boat, and it had a hole in the hull, and it was cold, and he had a kerosene heater, but he had to keep the hatches open. Otherwise he would, you know, the fumes and all. So she immediately invited him to come live with us. And he was an AA. And I thought to myself, he was a couple of years younger than me. And I thought to myself, oh, that poor guy. He's 23 years old and he's already not able to drink. I am so glad I don't have that problem. And because y'all, it never, ever once occurred to me, never, that alcohol was my problem. Never. There was always somebody drunker than me. There was always somebody sicker than me. You know, there was always a girl who was acting the fool worse than me. I was very calculated about making sure I surrounded myself with someone. I didn't want to be the drunkest one in the room, you know? I mean, even as a drunk, I knew that that's not attractive. And so anyway, it never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. And I do remember one time in college, someone came to speak to this group. Someone from AA came to speak to this, either it was a fraternity group or a sorority group, I don't remember. And we all just laughed at this person. It was so rude. It was so disrespectful. And it's so like, you know, I'm sure we can all see things through our lives that were ridiculous that we said and did. And here we are now, you know, the joke is on us. But so anyway, I had been exposed to AA just from someone coming to a social group that I was a part of or something, and me just laughing it off and thinking those poor saps. And especially when I heard them talk about God even more, I was like, bro, even more of those poor saps. So this guy was in AA, and I immediately felt sorry for him, and I immediately felt really uncomfortable about him, because I felt sure that he was watching what I was drinking, that he was judging what I was drinking. By then I had, I would drink whatever, but by then I was drinking scotch that stayed in the kitchen cabinet. And every day I would check to see if he was marking my bottle, because I knew that he was watching me. And he was, actually. He was, because, you know, we notice these things when we're not drinking and other people are. He was. And so I was trying to describe to somebody recently what happened on my bottom, and it's really very unexciting. I did not have the luxury of a huge slap in the face like a DUI. I started driving drunk before I had a driver's license, but I never got caught. I ran from the police into the woods many, many times, never got caught. You know, I never lost a job because of alcohol. I kept jobs because of alcohol. I might've quit jobs because of alcohol, but no one fired me because of alcohol. You know, I was always able to convince myself that none of these things were issues. And my bottom was not the result of a horrible, embarrassing, drunken escapade or an arrest or anything. And really what happened to me was that the reality of who and what I was and the chaos that I had created through lies, through not being honest about who I was and what I wanted, caught up with me in a person standing in front of me saying, "What is wrong with you? Why are you acting the way you act?" And I don't know why that was so huge for me, but for somebody that had been hiding and not owning or no accountability and no real identity at all, except for what they conveyed to other people, somebody asking me a question like that was absolutely terrifying. It was terrifying. What is going on with you? Who are you? Why are you acting? I had no idea. And I know that that is very unexciting. You know, there's no sirens, you know, but for me, that was a big deal. And I know today that all of that was God orchestrating all of this stuff. And I went home and I did, you know, I would do this a lot. I would come home, I would, you know, turn out the lights and lock the door. And this was, this shows you how old I am, unplug the phone from the wall and call out from work, not come out to eat, not bathe, you know, have a big old pity party, you know, a big, big old pity party. And, you know, my life is so terrible and I don't know what to do and I'm crazy and I, you know, I hurt people all the time. And this guy that was living with us, his name is Jeff, after a couple of days, he knocked on the door. I was like, oh, I don't want to talk to this guy, but he came in and, we started talking and, to make a long story short, he said to me, how much of your problems, because I was just singing the blues, all these things, all these people, victim, I don't know, they, crazy mom, crazy boyfriend, crazy boss, you know, everyone else. He said, how much of this do you think has to do with what you're drinking? I was like, nothing. What do you mean? And it was interesting because, of course, he had a friend that, of course, I started dating. And after a few months, that guy said, you know, I don't know if I want to hang out with you anymore because when you drink, you're not much fun. And I was shocked because I knew that I was fun. And so at that point in my head, I was like, oh, well, if I had a problem, I would be defensive. And I'm not going to be defensive because I was reading the situation. You know, I was reading the room and I'm not going to give that. I'm going to protect myself. And oh, okay, well, I just won't drink for a while. And I tried to control my drinking for 30 days. That's it. Not one of these people that came in. Oh, I tried to control my drinking for years and years and 30 days. That's all I could do. Anyway, so about the end of this 30 day period is when the reality came to me about really what a horrible person I was. And this guy came to me and he said, do you think that this has anything to do with what you drink? And I said, absolutely not. And then he said, you know, there's a lot of people that have felt exactly like you do now, but they're happy. I have no idea why that was magical. I have no idea. But that caught my attention. And I said, first of all, the crazy me was like, how do you know how I feel? How dare you assume to know how I feel? Very defiant, very defensive, but a people pleaser to the core. So I just shut my mouth. And then he started to tell me about himself. And what happened right then was the miracle of one alcoholic working with another. That is how it worked for me. This person who I seemingly had nothing in common with, okay? I even had disdain for him. I did not want to be attracted to anything he had to say, not at all. And he told me about himself because he knew he wasn't going to get anywhere trying to talk to me about me. So he told me, like we do, when we're talking with other alcoholics. He talked to me. He didn't give me, he told me about how he felt. He told me about how he felt in the world with other people. He told me about how he felt when he drank. He told me about how he felt when he didn't drink. But more importantly, he was able to talk to me about what he was afraid of. And honestly, I can't remember a whole lot more of that conversation other than I thought to myself, and it was not my voice. It was not my voice. It was God saying, this person knows you better than you know yourself. And that was not my voice. And then he said, well, you know, you've been in this bed for a while. You haven't eaten. You're kind of stinky. Why don't you get up and go to a meeting with me? And by then I was sure that I was crazy. I knew that I had mental problems. And I said, well, is it kind of like free group therapy? And he said, yeah. And so that was at like 7:45. And the meeting started at 8:30. The meetings there were super late. And I said, okay, not me. I did not wake up in the morning thinking, I'm going to AA this morning. No plan for that at all. And so I jumped in the shower and I went, and it was the meetings up there. Most of the format is that someone shares for like 20 minutes, they qualify, and then they open it up for discussion. And I have no idea how, but this woman told a story that it was God. Okay. I could relate to this woman. And it wasn't that I could relate, oh, I'm an alcoholic. What I could get to was, if I keep doing what I'm doing, I might be an alcoholic. That was as close as I could get. But that's okay. That was a start. And after the meeting, of course, I didn't introduce myself. Of course, I didn't pick up a white chip because that might mean I was committing. And so all these women came up to me. Oh, you're new. You're new. This one girl came up to me and she was super. I mean, I was wet from the shower. I was working in a bar again. I mean, I have a college degree. Thank you. And she was real put together and makeup and hair just right. And she was like, and my first thought was, you know, I don't want to talk to you. You're way too pretty. And she said, so she tricked me. She said, so what are you doing here? And I was like, well, you know, I'm having some problems and I think I just need therapy and I'm broke. I don't have any money to go see a therapist. And I should probably check myself in somewhere because I'm having a nervous breakdown because of all this stuff and all these people. And she said, well, tell me a little bit. And she said, well, basically I said, look, I've been living on my own and taking care of myself. And I practically raised myself with this super codependent mother, which is true. And you know, I've done this and I've done that and I'm this and I'm that. And she said, Felicia, look where you are. She said, you feel like you've been doing the best you can? I was like, yeah. She goes, you're in an AA meeting, honey. You're not doing really well. And boy, did that piss me off. Really, really made me mad. And she said, tell you what, I'm going to give you my number. And when, if anyone asks you if you have a sponsor, you can tell them I'm your sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was. Meanwhile, all these other women are coming up to me, hugging me, giving me their numbers. And I was so, there was such a conflict inside me because on one hand, I just wanted to melt into these women and let them just hug me, hug me, hug me. You know, on one hand, I just wanted to say, oh my God, you guys are so sweet and so nice. And then on the other hand, I was like, oh, you know, don't get too close. Do not get too close. And I walked out of that. It was called the Red House. It's right downtown in Annapolis. And I walked out of there and I threw every single number in the trash as I was walking past a trash can. And I went home and the loser guy that I was dating and my roommate and Jeff, the AA guy, were so excited that I went to a meeting and I was shocked. Why are you so excited? And they were. And I didn't have the heart to tell them I didn't like it. So because I'm a people pleaser, I kept going to AA meetings.
I did not believe that I was an alcoholic. And the miracle, again, of one alcoholic sharing with another one is what, over time, convinced me that I'm one of you. The longer I was here, the drunker I got. You know, the more I listened to you guys, the more I realized the things I was doing were not normal. The way I was working through life, the way I wasn't working through life, the way I interpreted information, the way I reacted to things was all not normal. And just because I had surrounded myself with people like that did not mean it was okay. You know, I had no idea about words like truth and friendship and love and honesty. I had no idea what a liar I was. I would tell you that, I could lie to you about anything for no reason at all. I remember one time when I was still drinking, there was this girl that I knew from Atlanta, and we both were living in DC, and she would call me periodically and want to go out. And, you know, I never wanted to commit to going out with her because I wanted to see if I got a better offer, you know? And I said yes one time, and then, you know, the night of, I got a better offer, and I called her, and I told her a lie. And she said to me, "Felicia, if you don't want to go, just tell me. You don't have to tell me a lie." And I was shocked and infuriated. How dare she? And I knew that I had lied to her. I honestly thought that doing that was okay. I honestly thought I was protecting her feelings. I honestly thought that all the years I lied to people because I didn't want to hurt their feelings was me being a coward and me not knowing what my truth was to tell someone. I did not know what that was. So I stayed in AA. I have a million great stories of AA. AA saved my life. That woman ended up being my sponsor. She actually texted me today. We're still super tight. I've had many sponsors. I've had many adventures and misadventures. But I want to talk briefly about the most recent, the reason why I like the concept of this meeting so much is that it talks about, I might get a little emotional. It describes in our own language the way that we established a relationship with God. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I did not want there to be, you could have told me to stand upside down naked in the parking lot, and I would have been more willing to do that than think about God. I did not want to do that. I thought that that was weak and foolish. So anyway, through the years, through a child being born very, very sick and almost dying, through lots of money, no money, through deaths, through, you know, life, if you stick around, life doesn't stop happening. You learn how to walk through life with some grace and dignity, and hopefully you're able to help someone else and you don't pick up another drink. And so I became over the years very comfortable with God and very comfortable calling my higher power God and referring to it all the time. However, there was a final frontier for me that I could not stick my toe into. And it really, I came to realize that it blocked me from the true, real depth and reliance on God that has always been available to me. And I stayed in a relationship for 27 years because I could not muster the strength to speak my voice. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. And I sat in denial and misery for so long because I could not speak my truth. And I let myself
become sicker and sicker and sicker without, I let myself become sick. I never drank. I was always coming to meetings, but I wasn't being truly honest for many, many, many years about the deepest secret that I had left, which was that I was in a bad situation and I let myself stay in there. And I, and a year and a half ago, about a year, whatever, I finally got to a point where the fear of the unknown and the burden of, and really a lot of it had to do with my kids, who by now are grown, they're 25 and 21, but I could not continue to let them see non-action. I could not continue to let them see me not using my voice. And so I left a bad situation. And by leaving a bad situation, my situation got worse, because the bad situation got super crazy, super, super crazy. And I had to learn all over again how to rely on AA. I had to learn how to listen intensely to everything everyone in meetings was telling me, because I believed beyond the shadow of a doubt that that was my God talking to me and pulling me through this situation that was horrendous. Horrendous. And I sat in the misery and uncomfortability of not responding the way my nature is to. You know, I wanted so badly to fire back and be ugly and spread rumors and, I mean, just do all kinds of retaliatory things. And I did not do that. I prayed every day. To stay focused on me and my truth. And I started through the steps again. I started to really rely on people that in a way that I never really had. And I'm saying that because I just want people to know that the path to a relationship with your higher power is very long and windy. And you may think you guys are like this, and then something happens and you realize you're like this, you know? And for a lot of years, I thought, I'm good with God. It's okay, you know, but I realized if I was really good with God, why wouldn't I speak my truth regardless of the circumstances? My entire life, I was afraid to speak my truth regardless of the circumstances. And, you know, unfortunately, I spent many years with someone that told me that my truth was not the truth. And I believed it. I believed that my truth was not the truth. And y'all, I was right. I know my truth. And there is no way that I could have gotten to that without AA and my higher power just leading me through. You know, every single day I got what felt like a neon blinking sign that I was making the right decision. I mean, it was overwhelming how things started falling into play. Things started falling into place. Never easy, okay? Extremely painful, extremely ugly. I have no money. I'm driving a car with no air conditioning because of this situation. But my sponsor kept telling me, be the woman your higher power wants you to be. You're going to walk through this with dignity and grace. And I desperately wanted to be that woman. I desperately wanted to not, I didn't want to get ugly. You know, I didn't want to get ugly. I did not want that anger and that toxicity and that hatred to consume me. And the only way, a lot of times, I could not let it consume me was just to not, I mean, not participating in awful things that someone is doing towards you to bring you down is very difficult. It's very, very difficult not to respond to every single solitary year's worth of bait and button push and horrendous, awful thing that actually you knew was going to come all along. That's one of the reasons why you were so afraid to do this. But I didn't respond. And I kept praying, praying, praying for peace for this person, for peace for me, for peace for our children, even when I didn't want to pray. I didn't want to do it. So anyway, I guess what I really want to leave you with is that if you keep coming, life is not going to stop happening. It is not. There's going to be crazy, crazy stuff that always happens. That is the human condition. We are not guaranteed anything at all, except that we're going to be born and we're going to die. I guess pay taxes, but it doesn't have to be so hard. You know, it doesn't have to be that hard. And there's no way I would have learned that without AA. There's no way I would have tangibly known that the universe is on my side, and that I don't know what that looks like, but everything will be okay. I know in my heart, down to my toes, no matter what happens, I will be okay. What that looks like, I don't know, but I trust that it will be okay as long as I don't pick up a drink or a drug. It just will. And the ability to change my perspective and be willing to trust that what comes to me is okay, even at first glance, I'm like, I don't think that's okay. But I can switch it around really quick and say, oh my gosh, this must be okay because it's coming my way. So I'm just going to accept it. I don't know if any of that made any sense, but I think that's all I have. Thank you very, very much. Oh, wow. Thank you.